Reading 4. And Gilgamesh went to the priestesses of the temple of Ishtar and asked the priestesses of the temple of Ishtar to send one of their women priestesses, later on falsely called sacred prostitutes. They were not prostitutes. They did not sell sex for money. They offered love as an act of devotion to the goddess. Gilgamesh sent the priestess with the hunter and another companion out into the wilderness to search for this man called Enkidu. Enkidu. And they came to the place after 3 days walking and sat down and waited for 5 days. And finally Enkidu appeared with the animals to drink water at the stream. The woman from the temple of Ishtar went towards Enkidu and exposed her nakedness to him and took his hand to touch her breast, whereupon Enkidu was suffused with feelings and sensations he had never felt before at this hairless being who spoke and made sounds from her throat that he had never heard before. And they made love for 9 days and 9 nights. It is said. After 9 days and 9 nights, the woman said to Gilgamesh, "We must bathe you. We must give you a haircut." They gave him a haircut. They bathed him. They anointed him in fragrant oils. They gave him human food to eat, sweetmeats, grain, breads, fruit, cooked flesh. And when Enkidu attempted to connect with his erstwhile animal friends, he found he could no longer do so. They shunned him because he smelled differently, and he could not keep up with them when they ran. His legs were as weakened. He could not run as fast as he could before. They escaped. He no longer had any contact with them. He was saddened by this. But the people and the woman encouraged him and took him with them to the city and told him about King Gilgamesh and his arrogant, tyrannical ways. And Enkidu said, "I will fight this man. I will right this wrong." And Enkidu came to the city where Gilgamesh was strutting down the main street. And they met in the main street. And they fought and wrestled for 2 days and 2 nights. And neither one could throw the other. And after many hours of battling and fighting, they stopped their fighting and embraced one another as brothers and friends, and henceforth were inseparable companions. And Enkidu came to live in the city and had a house and much wealth and a wife. And he and Gilgamesh went out and did many heroic deeds together. And this is the first part of the story, which is the story of humanity's transition from the wild state to the city-dwelling, cultured, Neolithic farming state, from the existence as wild, nomadic hunter-gatherers who lived in the fields in a wild state, in the wilderness. We were all wild men. not only do we have a wild man, wild woman within us, those are our ancestors. We were that for hundreds of thousands of years, much, much longer, 10 times as long as we were city-dwelling, farming, pastoralists, technological, literate people. So, and this story tells about the price that is paid for this separation from nature, for the separation from our own wild nature, our own instinctual nature, the loss of the communication and the communion that we had with the animals, and the knowledge of the land and the plants and the forests. For the advantage of city dwelling, of language, of sexuality. And it's the role of the woman. And it's very instructive to compare this story of the transition from wildness to culture, from nature to culture, from wildness to civilization, with the story in the book of Genesis, which was the story of the Abrahamic pastoralists that went out of Uruk to the land of Palestine. And the role of the woman in that story, where the woman is blamed for the decline from an Edenic state with really no advantage to the state that they then went into. The state outside of the Garden of Eden is a pure fall, a pure disaster. In the Gilgamesh story, which is older, Sumero-Babylonian story, the woman plays the crucial role. She plays the civilizing role, for which she is not blamed, but rather honored, as appears later on in the story. And also, there are advantages to the civilized life, while there is also recognition of the price that was paid. And later on, when Enkidu dies, he has a flashback hallucination on his deathbed of regret and even cursing both the hunter and the woman who seduced him and abducted him out of the wilderness. But the gods say to him, no, you should not curse the hunter or the woman, because they brought you into the cities, and they brought you the friendship of Gilgamesh, and they brought you life and a house and much wealth and a wife and a family. And then he says, yes, you're right, I take back my curse. I honor the woman, he says later on his deathbed. Enkidu says, I honor the woman. She shall be honored by all. Old men will take off their hat to her. The young men will take off their pants to her. It says. Inscribed in stone. Clay tablets. After a while of living in the city, Gilgamesh said to Enkidu, you and I should go out and to the great cedar forest and cut down some cedar trees, which we need to build more houses and walls, and kill the giant that lives in that forest, whose name is Humbaba, a great and terrific giant. And first Gilgamesh goes to the great, goes to Shamash, the sun god, and says, you know, I want to do this. And the sun god says, why? You know, and Gilgamesh says, because, and he says this to Enkidu too, because he is evil. Because he is evil, and we must rid the country of this evil. And Enkidu gets tears in his eyes and says, oh no, oh no, Gilgamesh, you don't know what you're saying. You don't know what you're getting us into. This giant, that Humbaba, that you want to kill, is a fierce and terrible and monstrous giant. He will wipe us both out. He will destroy us. You don't know that forest. I know it. I've been there. That forest is 10,000 leagues in every direction. It is huge. It is monstrous. We are in grave danger if we go there. And the gods have appointed that giant to guard that forest. That's the guardian of the forest. If we kill him, we will incur the wrath of the gods. And Gilgamesh said, don't worry. The two of us will do it together. We'll help each other. Why are you? Don't be afraid. I'll help you. I'll protect you. You protect me. And together, we can do it. That's what the hero always says. Regardless of whether he's a man or a woman. This is a story told from the man's point of view, but please recall that it's equally true of the woman. The hero and the hero are the parallel people, the wild man, the wild woman. So they go, and they march many days to come to the forest. Before he goes, Gilgamesh has the people of the city make magnificent weapons for him, great swords, great clubs, great axes, great shields, carved in bronze. And they go out and they march many days. And they come to the mountain. They cross 7 mountain ranges to come to the great cedar forest, where the great cedar trees are. And Gilgamesh goes up on the mountain and says prayers to Shamash, the sun god, who is his special protector. He says, will you protect me and help me in this? And Shamash says, first questions him, why do you want to do it? And Gilgamesh says, well, you have to rid the country of all this evil. Shamash says, well, all right, you know, I don't think it's that great an idea, but he bought the sacrifice. The god brought the sacrifice and said, okay, I'm compassionate, I'll help you, I'll give you these allies, and you'll have 7 fierce winds. The north wind and the stone, the icy wind and the frost wind and the hot wind that will be your allies in this fight against this terrific giant Humbaba if you should need them. And Gilgamesh had a dream on the mountain before they came to the forest. And in this dream, he dreamed that he and Enkidu were in the canyon underneath the mountain, and they were like tiny gnats under the mountain. And he had another dream, a second dream on another night, in which he dreamed that the mountain fell on him and crushed his body, pinned his body under the rock. And then a great light came out of the rock and turned into a light being, a light man figure, who lifted the rock up and freed him. And Gilgamesh told this dream to Enkidu, and Enkidu interpreted it. Throughout the story, Gilgamesh has dreams, and Enkidu is better at interpreting them and saying what they mean. The instinctual man, the wild man, is more intuitive, more connected with nature, more connected with the unconscious, altered states of consciousness. And he says, this is a very favorable dream. This means we will succeed in our fight against this giant because you have this light god helping you. And then Gilgamesh had a third dream, which was a disaster where dust clouds blackened the sky, volcanic eruptions, dust settled over everything. For many days and nights, nothing but darkness. They came to the forest. The forest was an enchanted forest. It had a magical, enchanted gate around it, outside of it. And when they came to the gate, Enkidu touched it and said to Gilgamesh, don't touch this gate. What just happened to me is that my whole arm and hand went paralyzed and weak when I touched the gate. So you have to smash the gates, he said to Enkidu. I leave it to you to think about what this means. This whole myth of going in and slaying the forest giant is the myth of our ecological catastrophe that we're presently in. We are the people, in the form of the lumber companies, supported by government and industry, who go in and cut down the giant cedar forests and the giant rainforests in the Amazon and the cedar forests in the Northwest, to build our cities, And in doing so, we violate the guardian spirits of nature that are assigned to protect those and maintain those groves, as sacred forests, sacred to the gods. So I think it's interesting to say that right here in this oldest myth of our culture, dating back to maybe 3,000 years BC, we have this ecological dilemma already indicated very clearly. Because then they go into the forest and the giant recedes into the inner recesses of the forest and they don't see him, and Gilgamesh proceeds to start cutting down the great cedar trees. This summer I was up on Vancouver Island, on the west coast of Vancouver Island, where they have these cedar forests, and where the connection between what's happening now and this myth became clear to me. These cedar trees sometimes grow over 1,000 years old. They are 50 or 60 feet in diameter. They are the most magnificent trees that you can imagine. And they're being cut down. So he proceeded to cut down these cedar trees. And when he had cut down very many of them, he fell into a coma, a sleep coma, from which he could not rouse himself for several days. Like Enkidu, who his wrist and hand got paralyzed, Gilgamesh cut down the cedar trees, he became paralyzed, fell into a coma. Humbaba, the giant, in the meantime, the giant forest guardian, heard the cedar trees being cut down and came out of the inner recesses of the forest to where Gilgamesh and Enkidu were, having cut down the trees. Enkidu managed to rouse Gilgamesh just in time from his sleep, and it is said that Humbaba fixed them with his fierce eye, his eye of death. He fixated them with his eye of death. As in another Sumerian myth, Ereshkigal, the goddess of death, fixates Inanna, the goddess of heaven, with the eye of death. And Gilgamesh calls upon the allies given to him by the sun god, the north wind and the frost wind and the icy wind and the hot wind and the fierce wind and the hurricane wind. And they come and they blow and they confuse and immobilize the giant so he cannot fight effectively. And so Enkidu and Gilgamesh are able to pounce upon the giant and cut off his head. And drag him, the body, and the cedar logs back to the city. Before they kill him, one other last telling episode. The giant, he's been caught by them, by the combination of the winds and Enkidu and Gilgamesh's strength. He's trapped. He's caught. He appeals to them. He says, "Don't kill me. I am doing my job here as guardian of the forest. You have seen the abode of the gods, which is in the inner recesses behind these forests, the beautiful Edenic garden, the garden of Ishtar, the garden of the sun god, are all protected by this forest. You have seen it. You should let me go. I am the guardian. I'm doing my job. I was sent here to protect this forest. Don't let me go." And Gilgamesh says, "Well, I'm inclined to agree with you. I think we should let you go. This catching animals and wild creatures is not such a good idea. I think we should let you go," Gilgamesh says. And Enkidu says, interestingly enough, "I don't think that's a good idea, because if you let him go, he'll kill you." So Enkidu is suspicious. He doesn't trust the other forest dweller, the other forest wild creature, because he knows basically what he wants is to escape, and he'll do his best to continue his role. So he says, "If you want to really get rid of this giant, you better kill him now while you got him, because if you don't, he'll get you." So Gilgamesh says, "Well, you're right." So they kill him. So it's a very interesting story, in that, it's the arrogant human still who wants to go out, who creates an enemy out of nature in order to exploit nature, calls nature evil. That's what the Christians did later on. And violates the sacred integrity of nature for his own exploitative ends, the wild instinctual part of him tries to warn him, but then when he does agree to go along, because he has no choice, because he is one with him, he is the same person, he then has a better understanding of what the real issue is and what really needs to be done to accomplish the objective. Where Gilgamesh still is more likely to be compassionate. So it's not a black and white story. It's not like Gilgamesh is all bad and Enkidu is all good, you know. It's not the noble savage either. It's the canny wild man. It's a very different thing. And they both together, after all, because they are together, they're both in the same fate. They both suffer the same fate and the same consequences. So then they go back to the city. That's the end of the second main story of that. And I'll just tell you the third one. I'll leave out the last one. Well, because I don't want to take too much time. The last one has to do, the third of these stories in this epic has to do with the story with the goddess Ishtar. So after they come back and they, you know, they get great admiration and the people of the city, oh, Gilgamesh, what a hero, and Enkidu, what a hero, what mighty men, what great heroes and warriors to have killed this huge giant, and look how huge this giant is, and his head is huge, and his body is huge. And Ishtar, the goddess, says to Gilgamesh, I want you for my lover. I want you to come and be my lover, and together we will have great enjoyment. And you will be my preferred lover, you who are so strong and virile. And Gilgamesh says, in this old, old tale, he says, I don't want to be your lover. Number one, I don't know what to give you. I wouldn't know how to feed a goddess, for example, the way I know how to take care of a wife. I wouldn't know what you need. And number two, and more importantly, what about the history of your previous lovers? What about Tammuz? Look what happened to him. He was your lover, and he got killed for your sake. And the people are still bemoaning him and crying, Tammuz, Tammuz, where are you? Where are you? Every year they cry for him. And what about the bird, the man that you turned into a bird? He was your lover, and now he's a bird with a broken wing who goes around flapping his wings in a paralyzed fashion. And what about the lion who became your lover? And look what happened to him. He got caught and killed by the lion hunters. And look about the stallion. What happened to him? He got caught and he got captured and made domestic, and he's now experiences the whip and the spur and the saddle. And what about that other man? And you turned him into a mole. He's under the ground. I don't want to be your lover. Look what happened to the others. And Ishtar was furious. This is a story of the male gods, the patriarchal hero warriors with their male gods and their reaction of fear and distrust of the goddess and of the feminine. And Ishtar just said, went to her father Anu and said, Ishtar, Gilgamesh has insulted me tremendously and I'm just enraged. And her father Anu said, well, you know what he said was true. That's your story. You did all those things. What can you expect? She said, I don't care. I've been grievously insulted and I demand that you give me the bull of heaven to punish these people. And if you don't allow me to send down the bull of heaven to punish these people, I'm going to open the gates of the underworld and allow the dead to come up and eat food with the living. See how you like that? And he said, well, okay. You can have the bull of heaven. The old gods knew the power of the goddess, even though, you know, it had been turned around where she's the daughter. Originally, of course, she's not the daughter, she's the mother of the gods. But that's how the myth got turned around. This myth is a very interesting myth of a hybrid of the old goddess culture myths, you know, the old creator goddess, created the gods and the humans, and the new male god, sky god mythology. It flips back and forth from one point of view to the other. And And Anu, her father, said, well, if you're going to send down the bull of heaven, you know, have you taken the precautionary measures? I mean, the people will be out of food for 7 years, and there'll be a tremendous famine and so forth. And she said, I've seen to it. They've got grain stored up. They'll be okay. They'll survive. She sent down the bull of heaven, which some people say is a drought. Some people say, I prefer the notion that it was like a flooding. Tigris and Euphrates Valley probably flooded, had numbers of devastating floods that simply wiped out. Because it said the bull of heaven came down, killed 100 men with his first snort, and his second snort, another 200 men, and another 300 men, wiped out hundreds of people, wiped out the cities, wiped out a major disaster, in other words. Gilgamesh and Enkidu attacked the bull of heaven, and in a great struggle, during which Enkidu leaped up on his bull's back, grasping him by the horns, leaped up on the bull's back, as they later on did in Crete at the bull games. And while riding on his back, seizing his tail in one hand and the horns in the other, and then Gilgamesh cut into his throat and heart with a sword, killed the bull of heaven with a great crash, and dragged him into the city, adding to their great accomplishments. And Ishtar was even more incensed, because now they had killed this semi-divine being that had been sent down by the gods. And the gods sat in council. And the oldest of the gods, Anu, said, they have killed the forest giant Humbaba. They have killed the bull of heaven. One of them must die. Let it be Gilgamesh, the one who cut down the cedar trees. And Enlil, the god of the sky god, said, No, Gilgamesh is my special protege, and it should be Enkidu who gets killed. Enkidu saw this whole scene, this god council, in a dream. And Shamash said, I don't think you should kill them at all, because after all, I helped them out. You know, they came to me offered me sacrifice, and I gave them allies. And Enlil got enraged at Shamash. See, the gods get enraged at each other. And said, yeah, well, you're like, you just go down there and hang out with those humans all the time. You're a real troublemaker yourself. So the decision was Enkidu was going to die. And Enkidu, actually, there's an extraordinary story too, but even before he has this dream, where the goddess Ishtar goes up on the city walls and complains and inveighs against them. They've killed not only the forest giant, now they've killed this bull of heaven, this special animal that she sent down. And they're both defiant, you know, and they say basically, fuck off, you know, we don't care about you. That wasn't inscribed in the tablets. I added that in. And Enkidu, it says, took the right thigh of the bull, which might actually be a gloss for the penis of the bull. We don't know. It says, took the right thigh of the bull, and hurled it at the goddess and said, this is what we'll do to you if we catch you. So they were naughty boys, to say the least, in relationship to the gods. They defied the gods. They insult the gods. This is what we still do. All the naughty boys and the big companies and the government. So after it was decided by the gods in council that Enkidu should die, Enkidu became sick and ill and started having these hallucinations, and had a vision of the land of the dead, where all the great kings and emperors, people of power and the priests and all, were wandering around in this dusty gray world with no light, and sitting at tables with dust and eating food with dust, and the land of the dead. And he had other dreams and he had visions, and he thought about his animal friends that he had left long ago, and he cursed, as I told you, the hunter, and he cursed the woman. And the god came and said, no, don't curse the hunter, don't curse the woman, they gave you this. And Gilgamesh was weeping and saying, "Oh my God, you know, what am I going to do? I'm just going crazy. I can't stand this. You're my best friend. You're my closest. Think of all the adventures we've had together and all the good times we've shared, and we're so close, and I'm going to miss you so terrible. I just can't tolerate this. What am I going to do?" And Enkidu gets sicker and sicker, and he has this fever, and he's hallucinating, and he's raving, and 7 days, and 8 days, and 10 days, and then finally he dies, and Gilgamesh goes crazy and tears off his hair, his clothes, and starts wandering through the wilderness, crying his name, and Enkidu, my brother, my friend, my other self, has died, what shall I do? I must go on the great journey to find the secret of life and death and what this is all about. And that's another whole part of the story, which I leave for now, having told you the story of how Enkidu, the wild man, came to the city through the woman. How Enkidu and Gilgamesh, together as hero warriors, fought and slew and cut down the forest and killed the spirit guardian of the forest. And how Enkidu and Gilgamesh insulted and rebuffed the goddess. And how then the price was paid, and that the animal part of the man dies. Eventually the man himself dies also. The animal part, the body part, dies first. And there's one counterpart I want to mention to you of this experience that Gilgamesh has in relationship to the goddess. Why does Gilgamesh say to the goddess, "I don't want to be your lover because you're such a faithless goddess, you know, look to the other people." What is that? And it came to me that that experience is analogous to an experience that I had in the desert when I first, on the wilderness vision quest, when I first realized that Mother Nature, so-called, does not give a shit about me personally, does not care for me personally, that I can be wiped out by a falling rock, a sudden drop in temperature if I'm unprepared, or losing my way, a landslide, any number of things in which my personal existence, my personal accomplishments, my personal happiness, security, well-being, recognition, reputation, none of those mean a whit for nature. That's why the limitation of the... So if you try to have a personal relationship like a lover to nature, you know, I love nature, sort of romantic ideal, you're likely to get clobbered, you're likely to get killed, because nature, as Maria Gambutta's called out, the old goddess is not really a mother goddess. That's the limitation of that mother metaphor for nature. It's an okay metaphor in one sense because it indicates we're a family. But it has a limitation because our mother is not like that. It means that you don't really take care. We are responsible for our own relationship to nature and for impeccability in our relationship with nature. We have to be observant. We have to be attentive. We have to study nature so we know our part in it and how we can survive and live in an adapted way with nature. Otherwise, we get... So that to me is the insight that's behind Gilgamesh's rejection. It's a kind of a petulant, spoiled adolescent kid, you know, who's rejected by the girl when he wants his first date kind of thing. But that's the experience behind it. It's this, the basic recognition of that nature is personally neutral towards us. I mean, she's not against us either. That's a misinterpretation of Gilgamesh. She's not out to do us in. Nature is doing her own thing. We are part of it. But it's not for us. So neither for us nor against us. She's neutral. But the petulant male adolescent who gets his ego bent out of shape says, "Oh, you know, you've rejected me. You know, I don't want to be your lover. I can't be your lover because look what happened to all these other guys." But we all get killed by nature in the end. Maybe by other people, but that's nature too, isn't it? So the story of how Gilgamesh Enkidu comes to the city, how the human makes peace with the animal wild man within, they become companions, which is the true relationship for them to have, how they then get overbearing and lose it by going and killing the forest guardian spirit, and then by rejecting the goddess and nature in a personal way, rather than understanding their proper role in relationship to nature. And then the final illusion, the last story, is that Gilgamesh thinks, well, he should be able to do something that will allow him to be immortal like the gods, and he has to learn that lesson too, that that's not going to happen. So that's the end of this part of the story of the hero, the goddess, the hero, and the wild man. Oh, hawk.
Why don't we... and all myths that are authentic and haven't been rewritten for daytime television maintain a kind of dreamlike, surreal quality. And so I'd like to tell you a story that I came upon a few months ago and was delighted. And I tell it to you in the hope that you can perhaps help me to understand it. Like all good stories, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, but I felt that there must be something important in it because it was very easy to memorize. So that clued me to the fact that there must be something in it. And this story comes from that ultimately pivotal moment in Western civilization when the last outpost of the goddess culture, which was Crete, Minoan Crete, fell and was in the process of falling to the pirate paternalists of Mycenae, who with advances in shipbuilding and an economic base built on grain were beginning to conquer the eastern Mediterranean, and one by one the last bastions of the goddess religion were falling. There were also great earthquakes in the eastern Mediterranean at this time, which also contributed to the disruption of this civilization. And the story that I want to tell is a story that occurs from the very oldest stratum of Greek mythology. This is not about the pantheon of classical or even Doric Greece. This is an older story, Mycenaean, perhaps older than that, going back even to the pastoralists coming out of Africa and into the Fertile Crescent. It's a story set in a setting which is probably familiar to most of you, although this story is only told in Pausanias and alluded to in Herodotus, so it is not a story that even classicists are too familiar with. Robert Graves, in his four-volume study of Greek mythology, gives it only passing reference. You may recall that King Minos was the king of Crete, and that he was most famous for having built a labyrinth in which to house the Minotaur. And I'm sure you know the story of the traversing of the labyrinth. And perhaps you know that King Minos built the labyrinth, had need of it, because his wife, Queen Pasiphae, was an extremely sensuous an experimentally minded young woman. And she became so interested in the sexual habits of cattle that she had Icarus, the craftsman who was later to break out of this scene on the Daedalus, the guy who was going to break out of this scene later on the first flying machine, she had him fashion for her an artificial cow in which she hid in order to have sexual union with the bulls in the royal flock. And out of this hanky-panky came the Minotaur. And her husband, trying to cover up this series of faux pas, built the labyrinth, installed the Minotaur in the labyrinth, and they grew older and did less swinging and began to settle down. But then comes the story I want to tell, which is a few years later, the king and the queen, apparently under quite normal conditions, conceived a child who was in due time born. And this child's name was Glaucus. Glaucus means blue-gray, and is to this day a term preserved in taxonomy to describe the blue-gray color typical of the peyote cactus and of the bruising reaction of psilocybin mushrooms. And young Glaucus had the run of the royal palace at Gnosis. And in his sixth year, he was exploring the pantries of the palace, and he discovered a huge urn filled with honey. And he took the lid off the honey urn and was reaching into it and fell into the honey and was drowned and died there. And no one knew what had become of the son of the king and the queen. And there was tumult, as you can imagine, in the court. And eventually, Queen Pasiphae, in a state of complete hysterical distraction, went to the great seer who advised the king's generals and the king's weathermakers. And she said, you must find our son. And the seer looked into the surface of oils poured on water and burned hyssop leaves. And he said, my magic is not sufficient to find your son, but I can lead you to one who can find your son. He said, the person, and this is the part of the myth which is so bizarre that you suspect that there must be textual corruption or some kind of misunderstanding, because it's so weird what follows. The seer said, the person who can lead you to your son is that person who can compose the most apt simile on the tricolored cow in your herds. What the tricolored cow is, what kind of code language we're dealing with, can only be a matter of conjecture. But obviously the story at this point is couched in a secret language which conveyed meaning only to the initiates. So the king and the queen commanded each citizen of the principality to appear before them and compose a simile on the tricolored cow. And there was a man there, a minor philosopher, whose name was Polyidos. And Polyidos, you only have to have spent 2 weeks in Greek before you transferred out to something a little less horrifying, to know that Polyidos means many ideas. So Polyidos, the man of many ideas, went before the court and he proposed a simile, which, according to the account of Pausanias, was brilliant. He doesn't preserve it, and hence it's lost forever. But whatever this simile was, it carried the day. And Polyidos was actually a very humble man, a minor healer and magician. And he was puzzled that out of all the people in the kingdom, he had been chosen, or he had by fate been singled out as the one who could solve this extremely racking dilemma of the lost son for the king and queen. And he said to the king, I have no idea how to go about this, how to find your son. And the queen flew into a rage and said, he should be sealed into a crypt with the body of our son. And he can come out when he comes out with our son alive. And so Polyidos was seized by force. And notice now the motifs of incarceration, the dark night of the...